Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Happy Thursday to you here at Catholic Answers Live. And you know that if it's Thursday, it's open forum on Catholic Answers Live. Open forum means any question that you have on the Catholic Church or her history or her people or her habits or anything else. Or if you have questions about morality or religion in general, we're happy to take those calls. You do not have to be Catholic to call. Anybody's welcome to call 888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884. A special hello to everybody who joined us for the pre-show on Facebook Live, YouTube Live, and Periscope. Thanks for that. And thank you for joining us, all our radio listeners around the world. Our guest this hour, Jimmy Akin, Senior Apologist for Catholic Answers. Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, how you doing, Si?
I'm doing really well. And I just found this book right here. I had no idea it was right
in
front of me.
Yeah, it time traveled.
I think we accomplished some time travel. This is A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. Just by Jimmy Akin.
Oh.
And my habit.
I've written that in
the past.
In the past, yep. Right. I get the past and the future mixed up a lot.
Uh-huh. So now what I like to do is just thumb.
I like to live in the moment.
Do you do? That's good. Is the
subtle
past
doctor,
real?
Subtle Doctor Who reference for people there.
What if I said, if I asked you, is the past real or is the future real? Just as like a short answer, what would you
say? I'd say they're real. Yeah. Now, not everybody thinks that, and the church doesn't have an official teaching on that. But I think it's implied not only by modern physics, but also it's implied by what the church teaches about God being outside of time and experiencing or being equally present to all moments in history. And I had a series of blog posts on that recently. So if people want to find out why I would say that, just Google Jimmy Akin and time, eternity, God, and it'll come up.
Was that on – I can't remember where the – was that for the National Catholic
Register? Yeah, it was Register? on my Register blog and also on jimmyakin.com. I cross-post everything I write on the internet at jimmyakin.com, so there will be a central hub people can go to.
Oh, I see. Okay. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-31-TRUTH. Open forum today. Please, any question that you've got having to do with – the Catholic faith or any religion at all or no religion at all. We're happy to take those questions today and answer them from a Catholic perspective. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Jimmy, on day 298, the following challenge is made to you.
Okay.
Probably by you. I don't know. Well, when you look at all the different religions in world history, the odds of yours being the right one are low. We should conclude that religious truth, even if it exists, is unknowable.
Well, if you want to use that argument with religion, you should be consistent and use it with everything else. For example, science. There are all kinds of different scientific theories that vary in small particular details. And so you could say, I mean, there's going to be typically each scientist is going to have his own view of things. I mean, with subtle differences from other scientists. So you could say there's – if you look at the odds of any single scientist being correct on everything, they're pretty low. Therefore, you should conclude scientific truth is unknowable.
Well, I don't want to conclude that.
Nobody would accept that. That's fallacious reasoning. And one of the things you realize when you start looking at science is even if there are variations in the details – those details cluster into larger and larger groups, the largest ones being called theories, like the theory of relativity would be a famous example of that. And the theories deal with overall, especially these larger scale theories, deal with the kind of most fundamental questions. And there's a lot of consensus among scientists on a lot of these big fundamental questions, and we can kind of organize science based on the answers to these larger questions. And if we can then determine, okay, there's good evidence for this answer on a larger question, then we can proceed to smaller sub-questions. And you can do the same thing with religion. You can say, okay, well, what's the ultimate nature of the divine? is there something divine or is there nothing that's divine? That's kind of an entry-level question. If you determine that there's something that's divine, is it one God or more than one God? If you determine it's one God, then you can start asking questions like, okay, has he manifested himself to us or not? And as you proceed to gather evidence concerning these larger questions, you can then build a foundation of information and proceed to ever more detailed questions the same way you can answer the big scientific questions first and then to proceed to more detailed ones. And you don't have to end up being skeptical about everything. If there are lots of different views on religion. I mean, you and I, I'm sure, have some different opinions on minor matters, which say the church hasn't defined. I don't know what they may be, but I'm sure they're there. And so that's true of everybody. If you take all human beings and, well, there's going to be some variation on details, even among people of the same religion and certainly among people everywhere. And so if you parse it in terms of, is there one person today who has the exact correct set of beliefs and how could we know that? Well, there's probably not, but or if there is, we couldn't know it. But that doesn't mean that you can't answer the big questions with a high degree of confidence. And it's the enterprise of apologetics to do that, to provide evidence for the Christian faith and Catholic apologetics for the Catholic faith specifically. And I would say that when you look at the evidence, instead of just making this kind of a priori probabilistic argument,
right?
To use a couple of $10 words, I don't have time to unpack.
Because you're an autodidact polymath.
Well, there are a couple more $10 words. We're up to $40 now. I just don't have time to explain them all. But if you take this without looking at the evidence, probabilistic argument. It's not reliable, but if you take an evidence-based approach where you proceed logically through the questions, then you can arrive at truth, at least on the broad questions, with a high degree of confidence.
And it sounds almost like exactly what a scientist does with science. You ask and answer questions about the evidence and see where it takes you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Jimmy, thank you. I think we got time to take a call before we go to a break. You want to go to a call? All right, we'll go to Sean in Denver, Colorado, listening on AM 1050. Sean, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. So my question is about two separate times now on two different college campuses.
Mm-hmm.
I've been approached by people who have invited me to a Bible study. And the first thing that both of them have said is that they can prove to me in the Bible that Jesus has already come a second time.
Okay.
And so I was wondering if you might know what denomination or group that is that claims that, and then what would be the best way to respond to something like that?
Well, I can think of different groups that have claimed things similar to that. Now, periodically throughout history, there are people who have a Messiah complex where they think that they're Jesus returned, or for their own purposes, they may just claim to be Jesus returned even though they don't believe it. An example I can think of off the top of my head who is like that is Charles Manson. He implied to his followers that he was Jesus Christ returned. For example, at one point told his followers, this is back in the 1960s, he told his followers that he had a vision of himself or a memory of himself being crucified and looking down and seeing the face of Mary Magdalene, who was his first follower in this life, Mary Bruner. And so he clearly implied to his disciples that he was Jesus Christ come back. And he's not the only one. Lots of people have either for crazy purposes or criminal purposes said exactly the same thing. So I don't know. It could be that this group you've encountered has a Messiah of that nature, that someone who's claiming to be Jesus returned, or they think somebody was Jesus returned. There's another possibility, though. There's a school of prophetic interpretation known as preterism, which holds that most of the biblical prophecies have already been fulfilled. And there's actually a significant amount of evidence for this view, I would say. If you look at Jesus's main prophecies in the Gospels, it looks like most of them have been fulfilled. Also, it looks like much of the material in Revelation has been fulfilled. Now, there's still stuff left to be fulfilled, but there is a group in conservative Protestantism that wants to say, and this is a rare view, this is not a common view, that wants to say it's all been fulfilled, that there is no more prophecy to be fulfilled. This view sometimes calls itself preterism, or they'll say consistent preterism because they would think everything's been fulfilled. Sometimes they're called pantelists, pantelism coming from roots in Greek that mean everything is finished. So it could be you've encountered a group of pantelists, and what they want to say, and there's an aspect of truth here that Jesus can come in more than one way, and we shouldn't necessarily expect all of his appearances to be the second coming. In fact, this is an aspect that has found a place in Catholic tradition as well, where between Christ's first coming and second coming, there's been what's called his middle coming or his Adventus Medius. And that's something that occurs multiple times in history between the first and second coming. But it's not the big visible coming that we're expecting. And that's really where the problem is with this group, because we're told explicitly in the New Testament, and specifically it's in Acts chapter 1, where it's also in the Gospels, where Jesus indicates that when he comes back, it's going to be blindingly obvious to everybody. And in Acts, we're told specifically he's going to descend from heaven the way he ascended previously. We haven't had the blindingly obvious descent from heaven yet, and so the second coming still lies in our future. But without more knowledge of the group, I couldn't really say too much more about it, but I hope that gives you kind of a framework for interpreting where they're coming from.
All right. Thank you. That helps a lot.
Awesome.
Thank you, Sean. We'll take a quick break here, and we'll be back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, everyone. This is country music artist Colin Ray. Do what I do and keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
We've all heard the words at the end of Mass.
Go forth and announce the gospel of the Lord.
But how exactly are you to do that? In his new book, The Old Evangelization, How to Spread the Faith Like Jesus Did, apologist Eric Sammons takes you back to the source, taking a look at what Jesus did when he preached the good news and drawing out the lessons he taught us. All evangelization begins with a personal encounter, and so Sammons examines Jesus' most instructive gospel encounters and discovers within each a particular truth that even 2,000 years later can help us make new disciples. Evangelization is not an option, but Christ's express command. What better way to answer this call than by imitating his supreme example? Order your copy of The Old Evangelization today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpin. In John 3:31, John the Baptist stated that the one who comes from the earth is earthly and speaks of earthly things. But the one who comes from heaven is above all. Whoever accepts his testimony certifies that God is trustworthy. It really all comes down to that, doesn't it? How we look at life and how we live it depends on whether we find God trustworthy or not. When we sin, we determine that we deserve to have our way over God's. We act as if we are more trustworthy, but we don't actually stop and reason the whole thing out. If we did, we would be far less likely to sin. What he wants from us is our trust, which is another word for faith. To trust him is to value him. It is to recognize just who he is and that he is everything to us. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour for Open Forum, which means any question you've got on the life or faith of the Catholic Church, we're happy to take. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-31-TRUTH. And let's go to Travis in Tupelo, Mississippi, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Travis, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good, okay. Thank you.
My question is this. I was on Facebook yesterday, and somebody had tagged me in a question they had put on Facebook.
Okay.
The question comes from a friend of mine he's the same age as me, but he doesn't go to church regularly anymore. He hasn't since he was a teenager. And
what's
the
question?
He got to debate with somebody at work. The question is, what happens to people that either have no direct knowledge of God, those that live in, say, remote areas of the world,
mm-hmm.
and babies that die before they're baptized,
okay.
or they're aborted?
Okay. In terms of people who are who have no direct knowledge of Jesus, God only holds them accountable for the knowledge they do have. So he's not going to condemn someone to hell who innocently, through no fault of their own, doesn't believe in Jesus. Jesus is the only way to come to God, but people can still be saved through Jesus Christ, even if they're not aware in this life of who Jesus is. And that would be the case, for example, let's say with a baptized baby. You know, if a baby dies in infancy, baby doesn't know about Jesus in this life, but is still saved through a connection with Jesus. And in the same way, people who are older, who have, say, never heard about Jesus, same way the baby doesn't understand about Jesus, as long as they otherwise respond to the grace they've been given, and the knowledge they have, then they can be saved through Jesus as well, because they haven't put any barriers between themselves and God. An example where that wouldn't happen is, let's say, the person has unrepented mortal sin, because we all have the law of God written in our hearts, and we know that there are certain things that are gravely wrong, and if we do those things and we don't repent, then we are putting a barrier between us and God. And so ignorance of Christ is not an excuse. It's not a get-into-heaven-free card.
Yeah.
But if someone, through no fault of their own, doesn't know about Jesus and his church, and they otherwise have a heart that wants to live up to the grace they've been given and follow God's law, and or, you know, the moral law as they understand it, which is God's law, then they can be saved through Christ anyway. In terms of what happens with unbaptized babies, God hasn't told us, it seems. We know that they won't be damned through no fault of their own, and we know that God is a loving and merciful God. And so the way the Catechism puts it is that we can entrust such children to the mercy of God. We don't know for sure what happens with them. Theologians have speculated about ways they could be saved through Jesus, even without knowing about him and even without baptism. But God hasn't told us, it seems. And so we need to kind of be circumspect about that and just recognize that we haven't been given all the answers at this point, but we do know that God is loving and merciful, and we can entrust the fate of such children to him.
Thank you very much, Travis, for that question. I hope that was helpful to you. We have, as you know, Jimmy, viewers on Facebook Live, YouTube Live, and Periscope.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally they type in a question. We try to get to those. And Trey on Facebook Live asks the following. What is the Catholic Church's response to Plato's
Euthyphro?
Euthyphro. I was having trouble there for a second. Euthyphro dilemma. Does God make things good, or does God like things because they are good?
Right. So this is a classic puzzle in philosophy. It goes back to the time of Plato, or even to the time of Socrates, Plato's mentor. That's a little ambiguous, but Plato wrote a series of dialogues between different characters, and originally the earliest dialogues, which are based more directly on his mentor Socrates, but over time he starts taking more liberties. In a dialogue called the Euthyphro, Socrates is interacting with, among other people, a gentleman named Euthyphro. And Socrates is asking a question about what makes things pious or good. Is something pious or good because the gods love it, or do the gods love it because it's pious? And this is an interesting puzzle, and it can be replicated in a Christian context. You could say, well, what's the ultimate standard of goodness? Is something good because God says it is, in which case goodness seems arbitrary? Mm-hmm. Or does God love something because it's objectively good, in which case God seems to be subordinated to an external standard of goodness? And that neither one of those is an attractive option. We don't want to say goodness is arbitrary, but we also don't want to say that God is subject to some other eternal coexisting standard of goodness. And so the standard answer in Christian circles, which I actually have in my book, A Daily Defense, is that God's own nature is the standard of goodness. And so consequently, it's not external to God, and it's also not arbitrary, that God as an all-perfect being is himself the standard by which all goodness is to be judged.
Thank you very much for that question, Trey, from Facebook Live. We have time. We go now to J.R. Mm. in Richmond, British Columbia, listening on the Catholic Answers app. J.R., you are on with Jimmy Akin.
Hi. So my question is, how do you explain why cohabitation is wrong to those who are not Christian? So okay. Without citing any scripture or church teaching, how would you explain it to them?
Okay. I actually just recorded a talk where I went into kind of this subject. It's called Understanding Chastity, and we're going to have it available on DVD very soon. So I'd point you to that for further information. But to give you kind of a capsule summary of it, basically, the obvious purpose of sexual relations is making babies, the same way the obvious function of eating is to nourish your body. And so there are other functions like bonding the spouses together, but the primary function of sexual relations is making babies. And babies need incredible amounts of care. There is an incredibly long list of things babies cannot do. Among other things, they can't drive, they can't walk, they can't crawl when they're born. They can't even find food. So they've got a sucking reflex, but the only way a baby survives is if somebody else takes the baby and puts its mouth in direct contact with a source of food. And so babies are very vulnerable, and they take years and years to mature, like 2 decades. So they need a stable, nurturing environment for a very long period of time. And the way God designed our species, or if you don't want to bring God into it, the way our species developed, the natural caretakers of children are their parents. And so the parents need to stay together for a very long time. And that's what marriage is. It's a permanent union between a man and a woman that's oriented to the good of the spouses and to the procreation and education of offspring. So if you're sleeping with each other outside of marriage, you're using the sexual faculty in a way that it's not designed to be used. And that's going to bring you one or another form of pain in the end, because every relationship that doesn't end in marriage is going to end in one or another form of pain, unless you and your spouse are both psychopaths and don't feel normal human emotions. So you're also being incredibly irresponsible in potentially having a baby or more with someone that you have not made a commitment with, so that the baby may not have the kind of nurturing, decades-long environment that it needs to grow to maturity. And basically, you shouldn't be engaging in baby-making behavior with someone you don't have that kind of commitment to, that commitment being the one we call marriage.
JR?
That's great. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, JR, for that call. More Open Forum coming up after this with our guest, Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-31-TRUTH. And if you're watching on one of those venues that you can watch on, if you type in a question, we'll try our best to get to that question. We'll be right back after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Glad you're with us. Join us on air with your questions today on Catholic Answers Live.
It may be true for you, but not for me. How often have you heard this during a discussion with friends or family? Whether talking about faith, morality, politics, or just the basic notion of truth, so many people are captive to the notion of relativism, the belief that reality is something we decide. In his new audio presentation, Your Truth, My Truth, apologist Carlo Broussard breaks down this intellectual cancer, looking at the different kinds of relativism we regularly encounter and demonstrating how, ultimately, they collapse under the weight of their own incoherence. More importantly, Carlo makes a powerful case for the existence of objective truth, showing you how to explain to others that right and wrong are both real and universal, because it was designed that way by God. Order your copy of Your Truth, My Truth by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Atheists have a new tactic when it comes to talking about the existence of God. Your arguments in favor of God don't even deserve a reply, they say. Because not only does God not exist, he doesn't even matter. In his new DVD, Why God Still Matters, apologist Carlo Broussard doesn't let them off so easy. He takes apart the premises of those who say God's irrelevant and teaches you what you need to demonstrate why God is just as important. In fact, in today's world, more important than ever. Don't let atheists shut down the argument before it begins. Get your copy of Why God Still Matters by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thank you very much for being with us today. 888-318-7884 is our number, and it is an open forum today. So any question you've got, we're happy to take that question. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and we go now to Ryan in Midland, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Ryan, you're on with Jimmy. What's your question?
Well, my question for you, Jimmy, is in a sacramentary and Sunday missal that I have, the first Eucharistic prayer, or the Roman canon, mentions St. Joseph, and I'm curious, why is it that St. Joseph was mentioned in the Eucharistic prayers back then after Vatican II if Pope Benedict inserted the mentioning of his name not long before he retired?
Ah, okay. So the Roman canon is, it's basically Eucharistic prayer number one. And that's the traditional Eucharistic prayer in the Latin Rite in the Church of Rome. But after Vatican II, there were additional Eucharistic prayers that became options in the Latin Rite of the Church in the ordinary form of Mass, and St. Joseph was not mentioned in all of those. And so what Pope Benedict did was he introduced the mention of Pope St. Joseph in all of the Eucharistic prayers that are in use in the Latin Rite. So that's not a standard part of every Eucharistic prayer.
Okay, Ryan?
Yeah, that sums it up. Do you mind if I add a really quick follow-up?
Really quick.
Okay. When John the 23rd introduced the 62 Roman Missal, did he by that time already know that he was going to call for Vatican II, or was he simply introducing a new and improved version of what Pius V introduced in 1570?
Well, those are kind of separate questions. John the 23rd knew that he was that there was going to be a second Vatican Council. In fact, he'd already called it by the time the 62 Missal came out. What the council might have asked for with regard to the liturgy was something that was undecided at that point. And what actually happened after the council was something even more unenvisionable by John the 23rd. But he perceived what he was doing in releasing the 62 Missal as simply making another modification, like there had been many previous modifications to the standard form of the liturgy, which had been codified for the Latin Rite by Pius V, although it has older roots. And this was just a new edition of that. He didn't foresee it as being the last one. And I assume that he recognized that the council might ask for some further revisions beyond what was in the 62 missile, although none of those had been decided at that point.
Thank you very much, Ryan, for that question. We go now to Danielle in Estacada, Oregon, listening on Modern Day Radio. Danielle, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi there. Thanks for so much for taking my call. Clarification, please. My family was told after the Easter Vigil Mass that when the Easter candle is dipped into the holy water, blessing the baptismal water, that is compared to the marital act. And that is actually the start of the church, which I thought to be Pentecost. So please tell me whether that is correct or not. The priest that actually told us that said that people aren't fond of that definition.
Or that claim?
Help me out, please, Jimmy. Thank you.
Sure. So here's the thing. You will encounter this claim. There are people, there's this idea out there that that's what this act symbolizes. However, and you even find some well-known people who've said this. However, when you investigate the claim, you find that it is not mentioned in the church's official documents. And so if you were to look, for example, in the Roman Missal that contains the official texts for this rite, it doesn't say anything about that. And so this is an idea that has been read into the liturgy that is not actually found in the liturgy. And it's also not found in other official documents that comment on the liturgy. So this is kind of a myth. My memory is that there's even a papal document or a Vatican document, at least, from the mid-20th century that rejects this claim and says that's not what's going on. However, my memory is not clear enough to remember exactly the source of that. But this subject came up a few years ago, and I remember discussing it with Janet Smith, and she had encountered this claim from a liturgist and assumed it was true, and then did further research and found out it's not. And I believe it was she that called my attention to the Vatican document, saying that this actually is not the church's understanding. So I kind of got to be a little cautious about that claim, but that's my memory at any event.
How's that, Danielle?
That's concerning. But that's concerning then if that's what's being taught in the seminary.
Well, it's I mean, it has the potential to run against pious sensibilities, obviously. And so, yeah, there's a source for concern there. But there are other sources of concern, too. And, you know, it's some of them actually, you know, there are worse things that could be taught in seminary, I guess, is one way of putting it. And so it's an understandable concern. It's also one of many potential concerns.
Thank you very much, Danielle, for that call. We go now to Thomas in Vero Beach, Florida, listening on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Thomas, you are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question.
Hi, Jimmy. How are you? My question has to do with your book on the Daily Defense, Day 18, The End of the World in the First Century. The challenge is early Christians believed that the world would end shortly after Jesus' ministry. It didn't. Therefore, Christianity is false.
Uh-huh.
Your defense is that this overestimates the belief in an imminent end. It also confused hope and expectations with assertions. I'm trying to figure out, is this doublespeak or is this what we know as cognitive dissonance theory, in a sense that we're trying to justify, especially if all scriptures are inspired by God. Mm-hmm. Were the first century Christians were apocalyptic?
Well, it depends on what you mean by apocalyptic. I mean, properly speaking, an apocalypse, the way the term is used in contemporary scholarship, is a kind of book that has or discourse, at least, that where somebody gets a vision from heaven that discloses either the supernatural world to them or the future in a certain way. It's commonly used to mean somebody who expects the imminent end of the world or the imminent arrival of the second coming. And so there's no doublespeak here. What I said is accurate. There is a confusion between that some people make when they approach this question between a hope and an expectation and an assertion. There are passages in the New Testament that reveal that many early Christians hoped that Jesus would come back soon. And there are passages that indicate that many of them expected that he would come back soon. But that's both of those are different than asserting he is definitely for a fact coming back soon. And we know that, and that's been divinely prophesied. And if you want to attack Christianity and say it's based on a false prophecy, the last is what you need. You need something that's an unambiguous declaration that Jesus is – that the second coming and the end of the world and all that stuff is going to happen really quick. And you don't have that. And certainly that was not something that was expected by all Christians. And you can show that because John, the author of the Apocalypse, the Revelation – from which the genre apocalypticism gets its name, has a period of more than 1,000 years before the end of the world. And so it's clear that not all early Christians were expecting an imminent end. And over the course of time, you can even see shifting expectations. Paul initially has some passages that suggest he might be alive at the time of the second coming. But if you look at 2 Timothy, which is he wrote shortly before his death, he's not expecting Jesus to come back before he dies. He's expecting that still to be in the future. So in approaching this question, you have to be sensitive to what's a passage that expresses hope versus what's a passage that expresses an expectation, and what would be a passage that absolutely asserts this is going to happen within a certain time frame. And we don't have passages of an unambiguous nature that do the last.
Thomas?
Got it. Jimmy, thank you so much. That explains a lot. So it's hope, expectation, and then...
assertion.
They have to...
Yeah.
Assertion. Then they have to... Thank you, Jimmy. That explains it a lot.
Awesome. No problem.
Thank you, Thomas. We'll take a quick break now. We'll be back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Call and ask Jimmy your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy Kellett, host of Catholic Answers Live, and I'm looking forward to meeting you this September 28th to 30th at our 4th Annual National Apologetics Conference here in beautiful San Diego. This is one conference you are not going to want to miss. The theme is the reunion of all Christians, and we've got an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to fire you up. Catholic historian Steve Weidenkopf, apologist Mark Brumley, apologist Devin Rose, plus all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. For almost 4 decades, Catholic Answers has been engaging our separated brethren in charity to bring them to the fullness of the truth. Join us for a lively and inspiring conference designed to help you play an active part in the reunion of all Christians. This is where it all begins. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite and inform your faith. Seats are available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today to register.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
We as Catholics need to stand strong, to be prepared to mount a daily defense, to respond to the many challenges that we, as believers, are presented with every day. Jimmy Akin is here to help. His innovative new book, A Daily Defense, takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, 366 in all, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, with challenges and answers indexed alphabetically, so finding the answers can be quick and easy. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. 2 hours of open forum today. Second hour, Father John Trigilio will be here to take your questions. This hour, Jimmy Akin, senior apologist at Catholic Answers, is here to address your questions. We go now to Beth in Belton, Missouri, listening on 1090 AM. Beth, you are on with Jimmy Akin.
Hi. I was approached by a school-aged child for a raffle ticket, and I did some research, and it was St. Mary's, Kansas, a SSPX community, and I did some research on them, and I was blown away by the wholesomeness and how they do the traditional Latin Mass and elementary education, college education, the catechism. It was just the most beautiful, thriving community that I've ever, I almost wanted to pick up and move there. My question is, why are they considered in schism with the church? What is the...
Well, they're not present. They're not presently considered in schism. What happened was in 1988, their founding archbishop, who was a man named Marcel Lefebvre, consecrated four bishops in defiance of an order from John Paul II not to do so. And this was at the end of a long series of events where they had agreed to some stuff with the Vatican, then they backed out of the agreements, and he then consecrated these four bishops against explicit papal instructions not to. And that means that he refused submission to the Roman pontiff. And that means he and the people who cooperated in this act went into a state of schism because, canonically speaking, schism is defined as the refusal of submission to the Roman pontiff or the refusal of communion with those who are in communion with the Roman pontiff. And so they fulfilled that first condition of refusal of submission to the Roman pontiff because they expressly defied an instruction from the Roman pontiff in a very grave matter. And so they not only incurred the penalty of excommunication, which they would have incurred anyway because that penalty is carried by the consecration of a bishop without a papal mandate. But they went further. They went they consecrated bishops against a papal mandate. And so that was a refusal of submission, and they went into schism. So also, according to John Paul II, did anybody who formally adhered to that schism. So that potentially means that priests of the Society of St. Pius X also went into schism because they were formally united to those bishops. Ordinary people who just attended SSPX chapels and stuff, they weren't necessarily in schism or not. They hadn't formally adhered to these to this, even though they were going to chapels run by such people. But what later happened is the excommunications were lifted, and you can't lift an excommunication on somebody who's in a state of schism, and because schism itself carries the penalty of excommunication. So as long as a Catholic is in has gone into a state of schism, they're automatically excommunicated. But the situation had been repaired enough by the time of Pope Benedict that the excommunications were lifted. And so at that point, or certainly no later than that point, the church no longer judged them to be in schism. Now, that doesn't mean the situation is all patched up. Hopefully it will get all patched up. But for many years, including even before the act of schism, the Society of St. Pius X had been breaking church law in a number of respects. Among other things, illicitly consecrating priests, because there are rules about who gets to consecrate a priest, and their territorial bishop needs to be involved, and that wasn't happening, and so there were problems of that nature. And they continue to operate a series of chapels independent of the local bishop in defiance of canon law, and they're still ordaining priests without all the formalities being observed. And so they're operating in an unlawful, or to put it nicely, an irregular situation. There are proposals on the table which hopefully will bear fruit very soon, to regularize their situation. And so, you know, God willing, for the sake of Christian unity and everything, that will all happen. But it hasn't happened yet. And so the language that you'll find people like, for example, Cardinal Mueller, the head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the language that he and other officials use is they'll talk about the restoration of full unity. Now, just because you're not in full unity with the church doesn't mean you're in a state of schism. Actually, the way Vatican II defines full unity, you not only need to not be in a state of schism, you need to be a you know, formal member of the church, you also need to be in a state of grace. And so anybody who is not fully united with the church, including being in a state of grace and in compliance with the church's laws and things like that, is in one or another degree of impaired unity. And so the way I think is best to characterize the status of the SSPX is that they're in a state of impaired unity because they're operating in an irregular or illegal manner in terms of the church's law, but they're not in a state of schism. So they are in substantial union with the church, but it's not the full union that Christ would desire. And hopefully that can be achieved soon.
Beth?
I hope so, too.
Amen to that, sister. All right. Thank you very much for that call. 888-318-7884 is the number. It's open forum today. And if we don't get to your call this hour, Father John Trigilio will be here next hour, and we will do our very best to get to that call. If you do intend to have a question today, maybe start dialing pretty soon because the lines do continue to fill up throughout the afternoon on open forum days in particular. And now we go to Doris in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, listening on Holy Spirit Radio. Doris, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Thank you. Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy.
I believe you hold the opinion that the monk, and I'm sorry, I don't remember his name, who computed the year in which Jesus was born, some 200 or 300 years after the fact.
It's a little later than that, but his name is Dionysius Exiguus, or Dennis the Short.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to know the facts that you rely on to come to the conclusion that that Dennis is. I'll call it a theory that
view.
Jesus was born in 1 AD was the correct time.
Oh, okay. Well, there's two things there. The first one is he didn't think Jesus was born in 1 AD or in AD 1 to put the initials in the correct position. He thought Jesus was born in 1 BC. And his calculation, I think, was, I mean, everybody agrees, it was pretty close. It was certainly within a decade. But most scholars believe he was somewhat off. And actually, I'm in that camp, too. I don't think Jesus was born in 1 BC. If you go back and look at the records we have from the early church fathers, the overwhelming consensus position of the sources is that Jesus was born either in the latter half of 3 BC or in 2 BC, in the first half of 2 BC, or in other words, what is known as the 42nd year of Augustus Caesar. That's the date that all of the different accounts converge on. And it's also supported by calculations based on the New Testament, because Luke indicates that Jesus's ministry began very shortly after the ministry of John the Baptist began. He tells us the year that John the Baptist's ministry began. It was the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar. He tells us Jesus was about 30 years old in that year. And so if you back up 30 years from the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar, you land in 3 or 2 BC. So there's good support even in the New Testament for the dating that we find in the early church fathers. Many scholars, and this is actually the majority position today, think that that's not right. And the reason they say that is because there is an idea popularized based on the writings of the Jewish historian Josephus that Herod the Great died in 4 BC. And if that's the case, since the Gospels of Matthew and Luke both say Jesus was born during the reign of Herod the Great, then Jesus couldn't have been born in 3 or 2 BC because Herod the Great died in 4 BC. And since the Magi in Matthew's gospel are inform Herod the Great that the Christ child was born up to 2 years earlier, a lot of scholars want to say, okay, so take his death in 4 BC, assume Jesus was born at least 2 years before that, so Jesus would have been born, say, 6 or 7 BC. The problem with that is the argument that Herod died in 4 BC falls apart on closer inspection. And the better evidence, which is also the traditional position, indicates that Herod died in 1 BC. And therefore, if you back up a couple years from that, guess what? We're in 3 or 2 BC, which fits with all the other data. If you're interested in reading more about that, and I've written about it online, so you could Google Jimmy Akin, Birth of Christ, and you'll get a series of blog posts about this. If you want to really go deep in the subject, there are a couple of books I can recommend. One of them is called The Handbook of Biblical Chronology by Jack Finnegan, and it's F-I-N-E-G-A-N, so just one N in the middle. But Jack Finnegan's Handbook of Biblical Chronology is an outstanding book. It's just come back into print. Also, there's a book by Andrew Steinman called From Abraham to Paul that also is very good and goes into this subject in great detail as well.
Doris?
That's great.
Thank you.
Is there any chance that I could get a copy of your article if I send in by snail mail a self-addressed envelope and stamped?
We could try to accommodate that, sure.
Thanks, Doris.
Oh, that would be great. That would be great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Let's see if we can get to one more call real quick. Let's go to Carol in Buffalo, New York, listening on iCatholic Radio. Carol, you are on with Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for taking my call. I often think about, I'm going to make this a Catholic question because it.
Okay. Please make it. Please make it really fast because we're right at the end of the show.
Okay, so if we're spiritual when we die, and we're in a non-time and space place, such as I'm assuming purgatory is, then how are we praying people out of purgatory? Like, how do they? Okay. How does that get racked up as far as time?
Okay. First of all, I'd quibble a little bit with saying praying people out of purgatory. We're praying for people, and God is the one who completes their purification and gets them out of purgatory. But that's just a linguistic quibble, so don't worry about that. The substantive issue is about time. And the idea that we leave time when we die is not church teaching. There's this huge misunderstanding on this point by people who, because they know we're going to be with God and they know God is outside of time, they assume that we're going to go outside of time too. It is not church teaching. John Paul II dealt with this in a series of audiences during his reign, where he talked about how time is characteristic of all creatures, including angels, and only God is fundamentally outside of time. So whereas time may work differently elsewhere than in this life, and we don't know too much about that, there's always some aspect of temporality to our being as creatures. And if you Google Jimmy Akin, time, eternity, afterlife, purgatory, heaven, you'll come to some relevant stuff. Hope that helps.
Thank you very much for that call, Carol. Thank you to everybody who called this hour. Another hour coming up of Open Forum here on Catholic Answers Live. Father John Trigilio will be with us for the next hour. Thank you very much, Jimmy Akin, for this hour.
Thank you very much, Cy Kellett, for this hour.
And we'll see you next time.
Okay.
I don't know what... Okay, I don't know when the next time is.
Next week, probably.
Okay, see you next week, Jimmy Akin. And you, the listener, hang on, though. We'll see you in just a few minutes here on Catholic Answers Live.